Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Maggie Levin here with me. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. What's going on?
You know, just same old in a box.
Yeah.
Just sitting in a box.
I'm so delighted to be in this box with you today.
Oh, cool. It's a small box. So I hope so. Maggie, we would love to introduce you to our listeners, so please allow me to do a This Is Your Life very
quickly.
I'm so
excited.
Maggie is a director and screenwriter with rock and roll roots. She got her start, did I say roots or roots?
I think you said roots.
Sometimes I do my Michigan accent. I'm like, roots.
You know, bring it out.
All right. Well, she's got rock and roll roots or roots, depending on where you're from. She got her start directing a metric fuck ton of music videos for artists such as Big Data, Anna Akana, Fast Friends, and more. In 2015, she created the Rocky Horror Hipster Show, a live Los Angeles club production that played to sold-out houses from 2015 to 2017. Then she jumped ship to branding, directing YouTube Multicultural's Register to Vote in a Minute 34 campaign, and an ad called The Witch's Spell for Dunkin' Donuts that was acknowledged by Adweek as one of the, quote, freakiest and funniest Halloween ads of 2017.
You know, I gotta throw in that poll quote. Thank you, Adweek.
Freakiest. You're so freaky. In 2016, Maggie got the chance to jump to short form narrative content, directing The Friendless Five for full screen and reteaming with Anna Akana to write and direct on season 2 of Miss 2059, a campy sci-fi drama from New Form Digital Go 90. And that's now available on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, as of a couple weeks ago.
And somewhere in there, she dabbled in VR, writing and directing Vane, This Party Sucks, an immersive 360 short about rave vampires.
Yes.
She recently completed her debut feature, though, and it's called My Valentine for Hulu and Blumhouse's Into the Dark horror anthology series. So that's available on Hulu. When?
February 7th.
Perfect timing, because
awesome.
My Valentine follows a pop singer whose ex-boyfriend manager steals her artistic identity for his new protege with violent ends.
Yes, indeed.
As one would expect and hope.
Oh, yeah. You know, whenever you're trapped in a club with your ex-boyfriend who's also a narcissistic sociopath, something's bound to go wrong.
Oh, some of us know what that's like.
You know?
Maggie is also the author of Something Wicked in Riverdale, an official Archie Comics text-based series available on the Yarn app.
Yes.
So lots of stuff, lots of things on the horizon. But Maggie, the movie that you chose to talk about today is The Lost Boys.
I love The Lost Boys.
Can you give us a little more explanation about why this is one of your fave genre films?
I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with style. I think we've seen a lot of iterations over many, many years of the sexy vampire. And my favorite flavor of the sexy and actually very scary vampire is in The Lost Boys. It, to me, captures the essence of what is like fun of the, about the particular era that it came out in. I think it has a lot of like wonderful elements about like youth culture from the time. The performances are really interesting. Overall, it's kind of like it doesn't feel the need to track a very traditional route to me. It kind of goes into the, it lapses into some sort of music video-y dream states, which is a thing that I did in My Valentine as well. Yeah, and it's just a fun rock and roll movie.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't seen The Lost Boys, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Lost Boys, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce The Lost Boys. Written by Janice Fisher, James Jeremias, and Jeffrey Boehm, and directed by Joel Schumacher for release in 1987, The Lost Boys stars Jason Patrick as Michael, a teen father figure for his brother Sam, played by Corey Haim. They move to Santa Carla with their divorced mom Lucy, played by Diane Wiest, to live with her wacky beach town dad. Lucy gets a job at a video store working for the kindly Max, and Michael quickly meets a beautiful girl, Star, but she seems to be attached to an aggro dude named David, played by Kiefer Sutherland. David taunts Michael and gets him to follow David's crew on motorcycles to a rad cliffside lair.
You know where Hudson's Bluff is overlooking the point?
I can't beat your bike.
You don't have to beat me, Michael. You just have to try and keep up.
Where they fuck with Michael and goad him into drinking blood.
Drink some of this, Michael. Be one of us.
Though, Star warns him not to. He drinks the blood and follows the guys to a trestle bridge over a foggy ravine. All the guys jump into the ravine when a train comes by, and Michael holds on for as long as he can until he falls too. But then he awakes in his bed at home, seemingly fine, but very weird. Meanwhile, Sam goes to a comic book store and meets the Frog Brothers, who tell Sam that Santa Carla is overrun by vampires.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
Which Sam definitely does not believe, until Michael, thirsty for blood, tries to attack Sam until their dog breaks it up. Sam consults with the frogs and realizes Michael is only half vampire since he hasn't fed yet.
Look, it says here that if you kill the head vampire, all half vampires will return to normal. Guys, if my brother's a vampire, believe me, he's only half.
Does your brother know who the head vampire is?
No, I don't think so.
Then you'll have to kill him. And if you don't, then we will.
And now they just have to kill the head vampire to turn Michael and Star back to humans. He thinks it's Max and tries to out him, but that doesn't work. Michael doesn't get the memo because David takes him to try to get him to feed on some surf punks. Luckily, Michael doesn't take the bait. The next day, Michael leads the boys to the vampire lair. They kill one of the vamps, poor Alex Winter, and escape with Star and a child vampire named Laddie. Then they hold up in their house and with a bunch of holy water and garlic baths, everything you need, waiting for the revenge. They fight the vampires and win, blowing up the plumbing with blood in the process, but Michael and Star don't turn. So Lucy returns home with Max to find the mess, and Max reveals himself as the true head vampire. Sam was right all along.
It was you I was after all along, Lucy.
What?
I knew that if I could get Sam and Michael into the family, there's no way you could say no.
Where's Michael?
It was all going to be so perfect, Lucy. Just like one big, happy family.
They end up killing Max, and Grandpa goes to the fridge for a snack, saying,
one thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach. All the damn vampires.
That was such a gorgeous synopsis. Thank you.
Let's get into it. Joel Schumacher, fascinating filmmaker and human.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of his body of work because it is resoundingly weird.
It's so strange.
He is such a strange, kind of humble person, actually, which is kind of lovely when you're listening to any of his commentaries or reading his interviews, because he's like pretty matter of fact, you know.
Yeah.
Like, his interviews are hilarious and so honest. And
I'm
you're
actually
like,
thinking,
what?
Like, I don't think I've ever listened to him speak. I've seen a ton of his movies, but I've never heard him speak.
Funny enough, despite the fact that he is on the older side, his voice has such a youthful sound to it. And I think that that's something that he probably carried throughout his life.
Yeah.
But what I would love to get into is the fact that this was actually a fairly low budget movie at the time. So there were a lot of concessions, and we're going to kind of go through some of these concessions and the creative ways that they kind of wrote and directed themselves out of things.
Yeah.
But one of the things is that they didn't have the money to do a lot of real vampire fun stuff for the effects. So he said, quote, "We didn't have a lot of time and money to make this movie. So one of the choices I made was to really not show the vampires as vampires or that they could fly until the end of the film.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford the effects. Everything is happening in camera. There are only two green screen shots in the entire movie. But a lot of times what you don't see is scarier than what you do see. So we were banking on that to get you through this and create a mystery."
That's so, I mean, it's so clever. And when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you can tell. Because a lot of the A lot of the early attacks on people that die of vampire devouring are just shown from the from camera perspective as we like zoom in and fly down towards the people that are going to get eaten.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was such a clever and very frightening way to do things because you don't know what the monster is until later.
Yeah. But I'm curious, you know, like if we can talk about in-camera effects and, you know, kind of what those will add and the kind of creativity that you have to come up with when you don't have a budget. Because I've seen budgets for Into the Dark and I know that they are very low.
And very like... there's very little time in the Into the Dark because Into the Dark kind of straddles a feature and TV world. Mm-hmm. It's features made on a TV schedule. It's one feature per month, which is madness. The fact that they're pulling off a movie per month is bananas. And, you know, I think I was really fortunate in a lot of ways in the process of like kind of knowing. Kind of working in a world that I was really already very familiar with, the sort of pop music world and the aesthetics and all of that, and including some of the actors that we were able to cast in it, I had a shorthand going in for a lot of different parts of this movie. But that didn't mean we weren't still figuring a lot of stuff out on the fly and figuring out how to make great things happen for very little money. And to me, that means always, I mean, you never have enough time or enough money, but certainly in the digital filmmaking world that I've come up through, being any kind of reliant on post or post effects or we're going to fix this with VFX, forget it. Like, just don't.
Yeah, that's not
going
to happen.
Don't even roll the dice on that. Just do it in camera. When that happens, which is all that's ever happened to me as a filmmaker, you just have to be extremely choosy about where you want your big payoffs to be and how you want them to happen. And the special effects, like in-camera special effects shot, the shots that you're going to spend a lot of time and effort on, because, I mean, that's another thing. It's like you just burn time trying to make somebody's like stomach explode or whatever. That's going to take like 4 hours out of your day,
and you can't do a quick reset on that.
And you can do it one time.
So it's an interesting thing with Joel Schumacher in the era of when this film was made and what you could get away with because of the era. So he said, Joel Schumacher said, I can't remember how many images are combined in that moment, and he's talking about the moment where Michael's drinking the blood. Very music video-esque.
Definitely.
Like probably the most music video-esque. So I don't know, I don't remember how many images are combined here, but MTV came out in the mid-80s, and we filmed this in 1986. So music videos educated a new generation to surreal images and non-sequitur storytelling. A lot of things we did in this movie would have seemed too odd to people before MTV, but that gave us a lot of license to play with things.
Yeah.
If I put myself back in that time in the early 80s before MTV, and you look at that kind of the transformation of Michael with, and there are many overlaid images in that shot. There's like, I would say at least 12 that are going on simultaneously fading in and out. And I just think that if you were pre-music videos, you'd be like, what the fuck is happening? I don't get it. You know, but music videos taught you that that's when, like,
you could go along with the surreal
right?
moment. Yeah, well, I mean, a thing that I love about making music videos is you really, you know, whatever plot you come up with or aesthetic artifice or whatnot, like, ultimately, you're just trying to communicate an effective visual to match the feeling of the song.
Yeah.
That's always your bottom line. I mean, sometimes branding gets involved and it's like, let's show off who the artist is. But I think that sort of surrealism and, like, the moment where he's transforming like that, or even the moment where they're stepping out into this concert and you're just sort of like feeling the like grimy danger of what is the name of the town?
Santa Carla.
Yes. You know, you are kind of lapsing into this it's our world, but it's almost like next door to our world, and you get more of like a the perfume of what this moment is supposed to be, the underlying feeling that's communicated more through music and related imagery. And,
And I would say, honestly, I wish that was kind of even more in our filmic vocabulary now, because I feel like that kind of surrealism has fallen out of favor for literalism in the past 10 to 15 years, something around that. And it's an interesting thing to see. It almost feels like it's a relic of the 80s and 90s, but I would like to see it come back.
Oh, girl, I hope you like my movie. I have tried to do a thing that I hope people enjoy. I hope we're ready for a comeback.
You know, speaking of, you were saying, like, what's the name of this town, Santa Carla? It is, I mean, come on, we all know it's Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
But it's called Santa Carla, and I think the funniest thing about that is it's because, quote, we had to change the name of the town from Santa Cruz to Santa Carla. They didn't want to be known for teenage violence, so they made us change the name so we could use the boardwalk.
Yeah. I mean, there is that line that the guys, the dad, grandpa character has about, like, if all of the buried bodies were to stand up at once, we'd have one hell of a population problem.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I can understand how a city and their tourism board would be like, I don't want to be associated with that.
I don't want it. But he did end up getting to use the boardwalk, and that was a really, I mean, we're talking about concessions and what you have to do, and it's just like, it's one simple thing, you know, changing the name. I don't think it was any kind of skin off of his back because he was like,
But sometimes you have to change a lot of have you had the experience of getting to the clearance phase of something?
Oh, God, the clearance phase. Tell people about the clearance phase.
So, like, depending on your schedule, but certainly in the schedule of Valentine, the script went through a clearance service. So basically somebody checking every word of it, every character name, every location, bar name, brand name, whatever happens in the whole body of the script for potential legal trouble or conflicts. And the rules are actually really interesting. So particularly with people's names, there have to be something like, I think it's like over 500 people of that name or zero.
Mm-hmm.
And anything in between that, if there's, you know, 22 people named your character name, like, you can't use it.
Yeah.
In our case, I think 3 days, 2 days before we shot, I got the clearance report back, and a whole bunch of our characters had to have different last names. They also send you a list of suggestions that are all preposterous. You're like, no human being has ever had a name like this. You're like, where
do you remember
get
any?
I can pull up the email so we can actually look at them. Some, because I was like, oh, this is a nightmare. And the name of the, so in the case of my movie, the name of our bar didn't clear, and nothing close to it cleared. So it was, and then there were like a couple of lines, like there was a reference to sucking a Costco-sized bag of dicks in the third act of my movie that they were like, we think Costco might not like this reference. I was like, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
What? I mean, Costco, don't they sell bags of dicks yet? They sell everything.
Surplus-sized bags of dicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someday. That's a great time for us to take a break. So when we come back, we'll be talking a little bit more about Jason Patrick and Schumacher's just obsession with him as being an actor. Also some of the production design of this, because it's so beautiful and very inventive. And the sax man.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, Alden Ford here with the cast of Mission to Zix.
Hello.
Our fourth season premieres on February 19th, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the show, we decided to ask one of our characters to give you a quick recap of what's happened so far. Say hello to the clone trooper, AJ.
Who are you people? What's happening?
Okay, AJ, put your gun down. AJ, can you just tell us what's happened in the Zix Quadrant in the last couple seasons?
Oh, well, we destroyed the Emperor.
Oh, really? Okay, great.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. We knocked him into a chasm. Mr. Robot Man and Barchi's ship crashed through a window, and Dar and Baby Horsehead and I took out, like, a bunch of bad guys. Papa fulfilled his destiny, and the lizard was there, too.
Okay, great. I guess I was sort of asking what the show is like.
Oh, you mean, like, it's an improvised, serialized wordplay space opera featuring brilliant sound design, incredible guest stars, and an epic, hilarious tale of Fresh versus Whack?
Oh, yeah, wow. Where did you come up with that?
Jesse Thorne told me to write that on my palm.
Okay, all right. Well, Mission to Zix Season 4 debuts on February 19th on Maximum Fun. Check it out.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Maggie Levin, and we're talking about The Lost Boys. Over the break, Maggie pulled up an email. She's got some fun names that Clearance suggested
yes.
for her film.
So there's a pop artist in My Valentine named Treasure, and this was wound up being a back-and-forth discussion with Clearance. We landed ultimately on Treasure spelled with two Z's instead of an S, which is fine. But the original suggestion said, this name is not clear. We find only one listing of an artist by this name. Advise use of the following clear names. Treasure hyphen A, Treasura, Treasura with a capital A, or Treasure Lady.
I like Treasure Lady best.
Yeah.
Treasure Lady with two Z's.
Uh-huh. Also, re Costco. The line was, I invite you to suck a Costco bag of dicks. Reference to the chain of Costco warehouse-style retail stores, which sell many items in large volume packaging. Advise avoid identification of Costco in this distasteful context, which could be construed as derogatory by Costco.
Which could be. I like that. Yeah. They're really giving you the benefit of the doubt on that one.
Yes.
Though.
You know.
So let's kind of get into this production design stuff that I promised here.
Yeah.
Bo Welch was the production designer on this. As Schumacher said, quote, the inside, and he's talking about
the lair?
The house, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Grandpa's house.
The Grandpa's house is awesome.
Yes. And he said, the inside is a set that Bo Welch built at WB, but as you see, you really feel like you're part of that environment. Welch was quite young. He had been an art director for a friend of mine. He did a great job as a production designer on a shoestring budget. And of course, he then went on to work with Tim Burton on Beetlejuice. But the exterior was Santa Cruz, and the interior was the set. It's a combination of thinking ahead to shoot the shots you need outside to make the interiors work. Whatever hard work and talent, all those wonderful heads of the department, though, it's actually the actors who make these scenes work. It's how they express themselves to make it real.
Yeah. Wow. I love that that is the same production designer as Beetlejuice, another one of my favorite movies with incredible production design. Yeah, I think you do get a real sense of that whole environment and all of the taxidermy things that mm-hmm. are in it, like all of the details in that world, the little flap on the refrigerator that says old fart that he keeps his like Oreos and things underneath. Like,
yeah.
You know, God is really in the details of production design. And certainly my experience working with Eve McCarney on My Valentine was incredible. You know, there's nothing quite like the experience of walking into a space that you dreamed up in your head and mm-hmm. then somebody built it.
Yeah.
It's magical. When I think about the production design of it also, I think about whoever the assistants were that were stuffing live worms and maggots into Chinese food containers.
Well.
God bless an art PA, you know?
There's actually a lot of interesting things revolving around
Stories around the worms and the maggots.
Yeah. I was going to say that, but let's get into this. So you're talking specifically about a scene that we should remind people. It's like right before he drinks the blood, David is kind of playing tricks on Michael and he's like, eat this Chinese food. And then it turns into, you know, worms and maggots and it just fucks with his head. Right.
Yeah.
So Schumacher says, quote, This scene was the concept of Jeff Boehm, who died recently and prematurely. If you're ever shooting a scene with maggots, they just lie there. But in order for them to go lively, you have to squeeze a little lemon juice on them.
Ah!
That's a tip from the maggot wrangler. When you have maggots, you have maggot wranglers. Then comes the worms and the worm wranglers. Now you know, lemon. The dogs...
I'm sorry, I'm just over here dying.
The dogs were so beautiful and easy to work with as well. There were two of them. One dog was trained to be kind and benign, and the other one was trained to snarl and leap. You don't want the dogs to do both because they might get mixed up and snarl or try to take a bite when they're doing in the fun scenes.
That's...
So there were a lot of animals on this, and you do need the maggot wranglers. You do need the worm wranglers in addition to a dog trainer.
Incredible. I just want to imagine, you know, somebody in the world has every single job. Somebody out there went through a career path that landed them at paid maggot wrangler.
Yeah.
That is astonishing.
And they know how to make a move, you know?
Yeah. I'd squeeze a little lemon on them. That is so repulsive. I've been getting into, I'm going to be directing a kind of a body horror music video piece. And I realized that as I've gotten older, I just have become like more and more desensitized and more excited by really gross things.
Yeah.
I think bugs are really the last frontier for me. I was just, when you were describing that, I was like over here just retching. I was like, yep, no, that still actually bothers me. I don't think that I could point a camera at that
They're just little animals. You just got to put them in. Got to get them all together.
I didn't have any animal. I still haven't worked with any animals or children, actually, in my film career so far.
So you've taken the advice.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think would love to work with dogs because I love dogs, but every experience that I hear about, I mean, that's rare, this report of the dogs being great to work with. I know two horror filmmakers, Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, just had a dog in their movie, and one of the first things I said to them was like, oh, I love, that dog is great.
And it was in Synchronic, right?
Yes. Yeah. And they were like, big eye roll, like, yeah, that dog was difficult.
Cats are also quite difficult.
Yep.
There's something you need to know when you're writing those things in, though, is just, being aware of what that means. And Joel Schumacher, being young in his career, he didn't know when he was reading the script that they had. He just didn't understand that it was like something that would take a lot of time. I think this was his fifth movie, actually.
Wow.
Strangely enough, it was his fifth movie, but at the same time, he just wasn't sure that his career was ever going to take off.
Yeah.
And he said, this is his fourth movie. He said, quote, this was my fourth film and I was just finishing, or I'm just finishing my 19th when he did the interview.
Wow.
And I didn't know then if there was going to be a fifth film. There was a lot of confusion at the studio because they didn't know if I was making a comedy or a horror film. And I said, yes. They didn't believe the two could work together. That was really their attitude at the time.
Wow. I mean, to me, the two things go beautifully together. They're natural partners.
I think it's really good to remember, like, putting yourself back in like his seat back then, that, you know, there were not a lot of people who wanted to break the rules. You had the 70s, which kind of blew the door open, and then the business people kind of took over again and took over the studios. And you had to be kind of forceful with doing things and do it on a low budget to get studios, you know, interested in it.
Yeah. One day I hope to be out of the business of making a lot with very little, but I think it's good training, you know. If I have the immense good fortune to make 19 movies, I feel like you carry the lessons of what you can make out of nothing from one thing to the next. And like learning to shoot lean was so my friend in this process of making this feature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it always will be. You know, I mean, it's 16 days and everybody that I've spoken to who's done bigger, longer features tends to have this reaction of like, what, how? It's like, well, you know, you just make it work, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go in with a plan and you get exactly what you can get.
Mm-hmm. And I think,
and then they tell you that you absolutely cannot go over time.
Yeah,
we cannot do a penalty anymore here.
Specific about that kind of thing.
Yep.
But, you know, I think for working in genre, you do have some leeway for some of that, which is good. If I'm thinking about what happened with The Lost Boys, what that meant was that, they kept pulling budget from him.
Really?
Yeah. So here's what he said. At the last minute, a lot of money was taken out of our budget. The trade-off was, Joel, if you want to make this with unknown actors, you have to make it for less money. So we didn't have enough money to build the set of The Lair, for instance.
Wow.
And that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
That, like, right before you go into production, your money is taken away because you're like, I want to go with unknown actors, which in the horror genre has been a kind of classical thing.
Yeah.
It's where you find new actors, generally.
Yeah, it's where you can launch people. I mean, honestly, in so many regards, like, I've just been having this experience in the past month or two as I sort of like step out into the horror community and meet other genre filmmakers and horror fans, just really understanding how this has historically been and continues to be a space to really take risks. A lot of that having to do with that, it's like, it's they tend to be low budget and they tend to be high returns because like a lot of people go to see horror. But yeah, I mean, like, you just got to make it work, right? I'm trying to think of specific stories from Valentine that I could tell here, but I'm in that honeymoon phase with the film is finished, and so I've blocked out some of the damage. But mostly, I think back on like, and maybe this was I'm hoping that there's a quote in that. In that quote pack of yours, that speaks to working with actors that you feel really, really strongly about, like belonging in those parts, because that's absolutely how I felt about my cast. You know, the two women who are at the helm of my movie, like I could not have made the same movie without them.
So I've got some things to say about that.
Yeah.
Yes. That Joel Schumacher only wanted Jason Patrick.
Yeah.
Only. It was like, I can only do this movie with Jason Patrick, even though he was like slightly unknown at that time. And unfortunately, Jason Patrick didn't want to do The Lost Boys. He said, quote, he was afraid it would be an exploitation movie. It took me and his manager 6 weeks to talk him into it, but there was no actor at the age of 18 with his looks and his talent. Jason has a wonderful paternal big brother quality.
Holy crap.
They were all 18.
They were all actual 18.
They were all actually 18.
That blows my mind.
Jamie Gertz was also 18.
Oh, my God.
And also, here's the thing that Joel Schumacher wanted originally for a Starz role, wanted her to be blonde and pretty and nothing, right?
Yeah.
He's just like, yeah, it's a horror film. That's what you got to do. And instead, Jason Patrick said, there's only one woman who can play this. And he said, it has to be Jamie Gertz. And so Schumacher said... she was 18 and she was Jason's idea. I was looking for a little blonde waif for this part and he kept saying, Jamie, Jamie, Jamie. And I met her and said, oh yeah, he's right. It should be Jamie. She's from Chicago and she's one of the loveliest young women in the world.
She's one of those arresting, like as soon as you see her, you feel the exact way that you're supposed to feel. Like you're like, yep, totally. I would follow her through a crowd of people. Get on a motorcycle, pursue her to my own demise. No problem. I got you. You get it right away.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that that's really kind of speaks to the fact. And also he has some really wonderful things to say about the Coreys and about Kiefer Sutherland as David and Alex Winter. The way that he talks about his actors you know, Diane Wiest to Edward Herman, who plays Max, who's a perennial character actor who can do pretty much anything.
Yeah.
He has such respect, but he knew that every single actor had to play those parts.
Yeah. I mean, cast is... my producer, Scott Derrickson, says this all the time, which is like, it just a movie is only as good as its lead performance. And I believe that through and through. Like, you build a world around... people, you know, we are ultimately, I think, seeing movies to see other people go through things. And I come from a performance background myself. I never wanted to be an actor, but I love actors in a way that I think, you know, I think that what they do is often miraculous. You know, I think about what Benedict Samuel did in My Valentine. You know, he plays this very erratic, so like going from charming narcissistic sociopath into full psychopath, just kind of like seamlessly hopping around all of these very extreme moods. And it also like tracks so fluidly, and he would just switch it on and switch it right off and turn to you and go like, oh, he's a really terrible guy, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And be like, you are a miracle, and thank you. Thank you for what you do. And one day, there was only one day on set where he was sort of like struggling with kind of the flow of a scene. And we talked through it a little bit, and he looked down and looked up at me. He's like, oh, it's really all in the text, always. I was like, I love you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, I promise we will get to Saxman.
Yes.
But we're going to go into some of Schumacher's techniques of working with actors and also, you know, some other fun little tidbits that I pull out here and there. We'll be
awesome.
Right back.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fan Time.
And I'm Travelle Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host. And the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fan Time is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ow.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Maggie Levin, and we're talking about The Lost Boys. So Schumacher had a very, I think, straightforward approach of working with his actors. It's very matter-of-fact. He does the, you know, as-if pretty, you know, consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, when he was directing the Frog Brothers, who all of those kids were 13 at the time.
Wow.
They were all exactly 13. And then all of the older ones were exactly 18. So he was working with kids who were actually that age. When he was directing the Frog Brothers, he said, I told the Frog Brothers that they were G.I. Joes, Commandos, Marines, and had no humor about any of this. And they're actually right. As crazy as it may seem, they turn out to be right. So you can kind of see that. And
that's so delightful.
It's nice because you can obviously see what they were thinking.
Yeah.
How it's, yeah, very
simple. The gravity
simple.
Of the situation. And it creates so much comedy for us to have. I mean, that's the thing about anybody, any performance really, is like you really have to buy what you're doing. So what, like a sort of simple genius thing to just connect to those kids to like, nope, you are a soldier.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, yeah, sure, I've seen G.I. Joe shit. And, you know, he said, quote, it was a great pleasure working with these young actors because a lot of what they're doing is their own invention. Any director who says they created performances and people is lying to you.
Yeah.
People either have talent or they don't. They either have humor or they don't. Mm-hmm. They either get the joke or they don't.
I find that to be true. I think, you know, there are a lot of ways to sort of skin the cat of a great performance, but I always appreciate actors who really do a lot of careful work on their own to create the thread of a performance. And that's something, I mean, you talk about like Diane Wiest, like, and everything she's ever done, including this. Like, you don't actually spend a lot of time with that character in this movie, I don't feel, but she, the palpable journey of that particular single mother trying to recuperate from whatever she's been through and like just get back on her feet and just date some nice guy. Like you feel that off of her in, so, I mean, I also love that scene where she meets Max and he gives her the lollipop and she, the way that she says like, I need a job. Like there's just something, your heart just goes like, oh, for this woman.
There's something that I thought was really interesting too, is the fact that, you know, you look at these supporting actors in this and, you know, Schumacher is obviously very open about like, oh, my God, they made this movie. You know, like they're the reason why it's great. But one of the things I thought was really interesting in all of this is the fact that Kiefer Sutherland was actually the one who has the least dialogue in the principal cast. And yet he's extremely memorable in this movie.
Yeah.
Which I think is really
yeah, you think of him as the face of the movie completely.
But, you know, Kiefer at that point in time, Schumacher said that he just seemed absolutely confident and assured of who he was playing and why he was there.
Yeah.
And I think that that was, you know, a large part of it. But Kiefer, to him, he said, had immediate screen presence. Like a, yeah. Apparently he had gone to the theater to see him in the close range and saw, because his part was mostly cut out except for a close-up in the end. And Schumacher saw that close-up and he was just like, get me that boy.
That's my guy. No, star quality is a real thing, I think. Like there is a, because it's not, you know, if being a movie star was just about having like a beautiful face, then, you know, everyone who's ever been a bit part on a CW show would be a movie star. Mm-hmm. There is an otherness, I think, a sort of like an otherness, but by that I mean like otherworldliness, a kind of like connectedness, not to get too art school, but like a connectedness to one's instrument. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just keep like crushing out on my cast, but like Britt Baron, who plays Valentine, for the first third of the movie, she barely has any dialogue. She's just reacting to like an experience of sort of re-encountering mm-hmm. a person that traumatized her and is in a full like almost panic shutdown, like barely able to speak for herself. She is still absolutely through and through all that time not speaking the star of the movie. And like for me, I'm like, I never get tired of looking at what she does, the tiny itty bitty things going on in her face as she's suffering to like get out from under this pile on of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's astonishing. And again, like couldn't have made the, I don't see how I could have made the same movie with another person, because like that is it is a tall order to ask of any actor to like just, yeah, you're the star of the movie, just react to stuff for
the
first third.
Be still, don't do anything.
Yeah, literally stand here and endure a triggered flooding experience and that's it. Yeah, and she nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at like Kiefer Sutherland, like so much of his role is just kind of like glowering or like looking sinister or looking like he's having a good time. And I'm like, I know exactly what this guy is thinking, right?
Yeah. Even the taunting scenes or whatever, you know, he says Michael a bunch of times, but a lot of times he just looks at him.
Yeah. He's not doing anything. And you're just like, oh, he's like reading his brain or something.
Mm-hmm.
We do have to talk about Saxman.
Let's talk about Saxman.
If you're willing, I mean, I'm waiting for people to wait till the end to talk about Saxman. But Saxman, this is Tim Capello was his name. And according to Schumacher, he was Tina Turner's sax player at the time. And he was covering a song by The Call called I Still Believe. But this is Schumacher. Tim did push-ups and lifted barbells between takes because he wanted to look perfect.
Yes. Well, he did a great job. What a shock, I think, the first time seeing that shot. And it seems so... Suddenly you're in, like, WWE or, like, Mortal Kombat or something, but he has a saxophone. It's one of those, like... almost non sequitur-esque moments in the movie, but then as I got to be a fan of the movie, that scene is mm-hmm. intrinsic, like it's so important. Like this is one of the reasons why I love Lost Boys, is this weird performance.
The iconography
this
of that
oiled man with this like greasy hair and all of that muscle.
Who is deeply committed.
Oh yeah.
And that's the entire cast, the entire crew, every person who's working on this movie is deeply committed, down to Saxman mm-hmm. doing push-ups and lifting weights between takes because he wants to look perfect.
That's what you want out of your movie making experience. You want everybody to be all the way in. And you can feel, I think you can feel the difference between movies where that was the case, where everybody was like, we're doing this, we're going whole hog.
Yeah.
And then people who like, well, I don't know, this might not be good. I'm not going to try all the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of the benefit of working with probably that young cast is like, yeah, we'll dive in. I'm not too old and too jaded at this point to mm-hmm. like give this 150 in a bizarre direction, and it really works.
Maggie, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about your film and The Lost Boys, and remind people they can see it February 7th.
Yes, on Hulu.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at switchbladesisters@maximumfun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/switchbladesisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
One thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach. All the damn vampires.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.